Welcome to the Roundtable Podcast, Episode 11. Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week on the Roundtable Podcast, we invite writers to come on the show and pitch their story ideas to Dave and I and our esteemed guest host.
And then we talk about it. We work it. We explore character and craft, process, flow, arc, theme, everything we can to try and transform that raw, naked idea into a solid, writable story, what we call literary gold. Oh, man. Brian, how are you doing,
bud? Because it was good for me listening to it.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I'm going to have a cigarette and just sit back and chill. Oh, man. Brian.
Yeah, I'm exhausted. Yeah.
I am. I'm exhausted, and we just got started, man. I'm ready.
I know. What's that all
about? Let's just cut through because we know who our guest host is. We don't have time to talk about you and me. We got to talk about him.
Absolutely.
Because it's all about me.
Because it's all about the man. Ding, 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 ding. Actually, we're going to use a whip for ours. You can have your bell. We're going to have a... That's what we're doing. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my singular pleasure to welcome back to the Skype line a man who proves that actors make better writers, the one, the only, T. Morris. T. Morris,
wow.
Welcome back, my friend.
I don't know what to make of that, but there you go.
No, I'm writing a blog post about actors have better mental and emotional equipment for writing good characters than anyone else. Because
I would argue it's more about dialogue. Because I tend to hear people say, oh, yeah, I have a real tough time with dialogue. I hear that often. You know, it's just hard. And the thing is, as an actor, you're constantly working with dialogue. So for me, dialogue, where it gets hard for me is, especially for fight scenes, is trying to describe, because I'm also a stage combatant, it's hard to describe pummeling somebody, you know, but like not getting lost in the terminology and things like that. But the dialogue, yeah. No, I got that down.
Well, but as an actor, you also have to evolve that rich emotional backstory. You have to listen to the dialogue so that every time you hear it, you react fresh rather than with a canned response. So there is going
to be... You have to get in the head of the character enough that if somebody drops their line, you can cover for them realistically.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And if you can get that deep into a character, then you can make anything up.
Oh, I can tell my story. I can tell my story now.
Go for it.
Here we go. Carry over from 20 Minutes with T. Morris. This is my acting story. I was playing Charles in Blythe Spirit.
Ah.
And in the opening scene, we're sitting there getting ready for the seance, and I'm over at the bar because it's an old coward play, and of course there's a bar.
And there's drinking.
As you do. And my lovely wife is there talking about Madame Arcati, who is the medium who's going to come in and hold this seance that launches this whole wacky romp. And so I'm sitting there and I'm working with these big splayed martini glasses on this very narrow, community theater bar. And she says something like, I forget what the line was. It's like, well, you know, Madame Arcati may want something sweeter. At which point I knock over one of the martini glasses and it shatters on the floor in front of me. At which point I look up over at my wife and say, well, dear, it doesn't look like Madame Arcati is going to be drinking much of anything now, does it? would you fetch the maid? Because, of course, it's an old coward play, so there's a maid. And so our maid is backstage, and
she's
comes out.
She's probably having a cigarette break. She's probably going, that son of a bitch did what?
Why is he calling me in? My scene doesn't start in 20 minutes.
Exactly.
So we carry on with the scene while the maid, bless her heart, comes on with a dustpan, a very 20th century looking dustpan, I might mind you.
That's commitment.
But
though.
Man, that's been commitment. That was awesome. And I got an ovation for that. I didn't get it.
Yeah, I bet you did.
That was awesome. So, all right, T. Morris, Man About Town. An epic roller coaster ride that just seems to be going up, up, and up, and I hope it never, ever goes down for you.
You and me both, bro.
Man. Although, hold on tight, it's going faster.
Considering how my year started, I'm okay with this ride.
The pendulum swing is not necessarily a good lifestyle choice, man.
No, it ain't.
But give our audience just a taste, because we only got like 10 minutes here,
right.
Of what they should be looking for in the next few months from the desk of T. Morris.
Well, you've always got Tales from the Archives, which can be found at ministryofpeculiarcurrences.com. That is our free free podcast that introduces you to the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. We have the Janus Affair that is coming out at the end of May. And the Janus Affair, which I wrote with my lovely wife, Pip Ballantyne, that's coming out. That is the sequel to the award-winning Phoenix Rising, which came out last year. And after that, there's going to be more short story goodness with Tales from the Archives. And possibly, if time and ideas allow, there's going to be the current working project. It's called Operation Darkwater.
Ooh.
And that is the steampunk reboot of Moravia.
There's, oh my God!
There is a taste. Oh, crap. There is a taste of it. There is a taste of it in Tales from the Archives, Volume 1. There's a short story. It's available as a 99-cent penny, as a 99-penny dreadful. For your Kindle and other reading devices, or it is available as a free podcast in Volume 1. It's called Darkest Before the Dark Water, and you get a taste of the steampunk Rafe Rafton.
Oh, my God. Awesome. Awesome. So, especially for those of us that are big Moravia fans. So, yeah. Yes.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you know it. You know it. Plus, fabulous. Of course, there's Aladdin and his wonderfully infernal advice. Advice.
Yes.
Device. out there on Kindle still.
The wonderfully still infernal advice will be this second.
Yeah, one. That's coming up there next. That's the rest up. Of the show.
And yeah. Oh yeah, and there's also the re-release digitally, the digital re-release of The Case of the Singing Sword and The Case of the Pitcher's Pendant, Billabub Batting's Mysteries. They're back now and they are available for the Kindle and for Nook and otherwise. And the deal is this, basically. The deal is this. If enough of those puppies sell digitally, and I start to see a real demand for it, yes, there will be more Billy. But awesome. I got to see the demand first. It's that simple.
Let me ask you something. And this is okay, kid gloves are off. I got a question.
Oh, boy.
Aren't we supposed to be talking to you?
Yeah, well, you know.
Is this part two of the Writers' Roundtable, the 20 minutes? And yes, I'm doing air quotes as I say 20 minutes.
We got three more minutes. It's my show. Our show. We can do this. This totally makes me crazy. And maybe you can diffuse my madness. If you have a story to tell, T, if there's another Billabub Batting story to tell, are you not fucking going to tell it anyway, whether the fans want it or not?
Yeah, didn't we distinguish that you if you want to tell a story, you write it and then figure out what to do with it later.
And don't throw a guilt trip on the fans that only if we come back and say, "Ooh, please, T, give us this more."
He wanted to talk about marketing, and we told him no.
Okay,
and this is what he's right. doing.
No. That it's a fair question. It's a fair question. and what the final word is it comes down to priorities. It really does come down to priorities because I have an idea for a full-length novel, time travel, erotic thriller. I've got an idea for a steampunk fairy tale, working title, Little Red Flying Hood. I've got the Moravia steampunk reboot, Project Darkwater. I've also got the third Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, which is called By Dawn's Early Light. Let me jump in.
I realize now, just in you telling that, you've already answered the question. I'm sitting here in my ivory tower without a book to my name, talking out of my ass, asking you about the pure aesthetics of writing the story if you feel it. And what you're telling me is you have more stories than you can write in a lifetime.
Crazy Uncle Charlie would say, this is what makes you a douchebag.
I accept my douchebag status wholeheartedly. You're absolutely right.
And keep in mind, on top of all this, until I start getting the New York Times bestseller numbers, I still have to have that day job. I still got to pay the bills.
I hear you.
Because as much as I want to be a writer, being a dad and being a husband has to come first. No matter how good you are as a writer, if you're not living your life, your writing is just a lot of ink on paper. You got to live your life.
Boom. Ring that bell. Ring that bell. That's awesome.
Bitches.
Bitches. Okay. So having established that Dave is indeed an effete douchebag who sits in his ivory tower, let's go ahead and
eventually you will become that F-14 of awesome. You will. Just plenty of vodka. And of course, I just got to say this right now. I've been listening here to your voice, Dave, and I just got to say, you are a beautiful woman. I could love you bizarrely.
Oh, God, put him back. Put him. Pip!
The scary thing for those people who are attending Balticon, you can find out more at balticon.org.
Ding.
We are going to be doing, we're going to be combining the launch of the Janus Affair with a live recording of the Shared Desk. And I can promise, yes, Crazy Uncle Charlie will be live
awesome.
At Balticon.
I think.
So get ready for that.
I see prosthetics in our future. Oh, my God. sad and scary. Well, yeah, I'm going to be at Balticon too, bud. So at some point, we're going to have to get into the same room and
have a scotch and just chill. That'd be good.
Yeah. I don't think chill is going to be on the list, dude.
But we'll fire up the mics and just go.
There you go. But right now, why don't we fire up a promo, definitely kept our guest writer on the line long enough. We'll take a break for a promo. We come back, we'll hear a story idea, and we'll do some workshopping. Sound good?
Good.
Let's do it to it.
Awesome. All right. We'll be right back, folks. Stay tuned.
Yes, we know there's a million podcasts out there, but there's only one Hollywood Outsider. Every week, your hoes, Aaron, Brian, Justin, and Scott, put their own spin on the latest in movie and TV news, new and upcoming releases, topics that are on ours or our listeners' minds, and hell, we even throw in some trivia where you can win a cavalcade of imaginary prizes. Most importantly, we have fun doing it. So come take a listen. Hollywood Outsider is available on iTunes, Zune, Stitcher Radio, or at thehollywoodoutsider.com.
All right, we're back, and now comes the fun part. Now comes the meat and potatoes, the, dare I say, the thrust of the Roundtable Podcast. And every time I say that, somebody giggles somewhere.
I was just going to say, I didn't realize it was that kind of podcast.
We're going to earn that explicit rating, baby. But let's bring our guest writer onto the show. And for this episode, we are very pleased to have not only a writer, but also a podcaster, the host and producer of the Way of the Buffalo podcast, bringing new fiction to the podosphere. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Skype line, Mr. Hugh O'Donnell. Hugh, thank you, man, for stepping up and offering up your story for the Roundtable Podcast.
Thanks. It's really nice to be here.
Yeah, likewise. Now, you and T already have history, right?
About a week.
Yeah, see, that's that with tea time, that's like a year. All right. So
that's why Pip is looking rather tired and worn and
yeah, that's like what they're saying. That's what they're saying anyway.
Dude, the douchebaggery is showing again. She's listening right now.
Oh man. I am so toast.
Oh, he's going to be a Balticon, baby. So.
And I called Scott Sigler a tool last week. So, man, I am.
Hey, you were just reporting the facts.
Sorry. Can I hide behind you? Awesome. More effete douchebaggery. Awesome. Hugh, this is your time, man. Believe it or not.
Bail us out, Hugh. Come on.
I'll also be at Balticon so I can run interference.
Oh, you are the man. You are so the man. Where are you right now? What are you doing? And how did you get into writing?
Well, I live in Buffalo, New York, and I actually got into writing through National Novel Writing Month.
Really?
Yeah, I decided one year just, you know, to give it a shot, because I was one of those people that says, like, well, I have an idea, but someday I'll write a book when I'm less busy.
And yeah, that never happens.
Yeah, and through NaNoWriMo, actually, I met a lot of great local writers in my area. I ended up joining a local writers group, and it's just been, you know, turned to 11 and going from there.
That's awesome. And the NaNoWriMo really is a great networking opportunity, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's fabulous. And did you finish? Did you achieve NaNoWriMo-age?
Out of all the years I've done it, I think I've done it for like 5 or 6 years, and I've failed maybe twice.
Dude, 5 or 6 wow. NaNoWriMos. That is huge.
Hang on. Now here's my question though, Hugh. Are you writing on a regular basis now? Are you writing on a regular basis? Do you write in other months other than November?
Yes, but not enough.
No. If you are writing in other months of November, then in my opinion, you've never failed. Because it's the people that only write on NaNoWriMo and they call themselves novelists. That's what I'm like, no, you're a NaNoWriMo participant. But if you get into some kind of yearly habit and you are writing every month, whether it's 10,000 words in 1 month or 5,000 words in 1 month or even 1,000 words in 1 month, if you are writing in other months than November, then you have never failed NaNoWriMo, because that's the point of NaNoWriMo. It's not to write a book in a month. It's to get your ass in the chair and get you in a regimen. I have constantly argued that, and it pisses me off when I meet these authors that they're, I'm like, what are you working on now? Oh, I don't work on anything until November. Well, then you're an idiot, aren't you? I mean, I'm sorry.
You're an effete douchebag.
Yes. Let's go, Dave. How is Dave? Sorry. It was out there. You put it out there.
I did, and you picked it up. I knew you would. Bless your heart.
But NaNoWriMo is great. I think everyone should do it and learn the habit to keep doing it.
Yes.
I was lucky to start doing it with a group of great writers who have also gone on to at least, you know, self-publishing success. And I'm actually working on the audiobook for a friend of mine's novel right now, which is called The Dark Wife.
Very cool. Are you narrating, or is this going to be a full cast, or what?
It's going to be narrated by Veronica Jaeger.
Oh, my God. V for
Nicely
voice.
Nicely done, sir. Nicely done.
Awesome.
It is actually
a lesbian
romance, so it would sound a bit odd if I narrated it.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's fabulous. Yeah, you don't want to go there. I understand you got a story for us, man.
Yes. Okay. So.
All right. So the mic is yours, T. The mic is his. Silence is golden.
That's good. He's well trained.
He is. Ding. All right, man. 5 to 8 minutes. Give us the primary antagonist, protagonist, the theme. Walk us through some plot points. Get as far as you've gotten, and we'll take it from there, bud. The mic is yours.
Okay. So this novel is called Firewalker.
It sucks. Next. All right. I've been dying to do that on shows like this. Okay.
Okay, really, Hugh, the mic is yours.
It's a kind of interstitial fantasy romance mystery thing. The hook is that a powerful wizard must unravel a deadly mystery when he finds himself trapped in a strange village without his magic or even his senses. So this is a novel about learning to see illusions and learning to trust your instincts. Hmm. It's set in a vast magical magical empire that's tearing itself apart in a long bloody war succession. The main character, whose name is Firewalker, is the member of a secretive order of magicians and mercenaries called Sensates, who are, as mercenaries, not really favoring one side or the other. And their big secret is that their magic and training comes from having synesthesia. And for those who don't know, this is a real medical condition where people have the nerves that process their senses very close together. So they can do things like they can see color, or they can like hear color, or often they'll see letters as particular shades of a certain color. And there's a lot of really interesting things there. And so this is 10 years into this war, and nearing 30, Firewalker is very tired. He's been fighting for 10 years, advising one side or the other. He wants to retire to either teach new students or raise a family. Instead, he's sent by his superiors to advise a warlord of a supposedly impregnable castle whose neighbors have turned against him. Before he leaves, he tells his friend Rootfinder, who is a tracker who just got a young apprentice, that he feels like he's going on a suicide mission. And it's worse than he thinks. By the time Firewalker arrives, the warlord's dead, his son is taking over, and he doesn't want to wait out a siege. He wants to just go head on. Of course, this goes really badly. Firewalker quickly finds himself alone on the battlefield, and he's attacked by some sort of chemical weapon, which burns him, and then he fights to what he thinks is the death. He wakes up and finds that all of his senses have stopped working. Over the course of a few days, they start to return, and he discovers that he has wandered into some kind of secluded village. He is badly wounded and can't use any magic. He discovers that he was saved by this young and beautiful chieftain named Tahira, and she is the leader of the village. Her father, who was the had recently died, or was lost in a storm, and they fear he's dead. The village elders are constantly squabbling with her, and they openly distrust Firewalker. Even so, as he recovers, he finds a sort of peace in the little valley. He meets the inhabitants and is told that he's stuck there for the foreseeable future. The weather is unpredictable and the valley walls are too high to climb. Firewalker's charmed by the village, but he suspects something is strange is going on. After a few weeks, he accompanies Tahira on one of her duties, which is taking food to an elder who lives out in the valley forest, where he keeps a shrine. There, they learn that there might be more to her father's death than they thought, and Firewalker vows to help her solve the mystery of what happened to her father. As he investigates, Firewalker discovers a lot of things that seem to make no sense about the village. He can't get an accurate history, and he suspects that there's a very big secret that they're keeping from him. At the same time, his relationship with Tahira becomes extremely serious. He's interrupted in this search when a woman in the village who is in labor starts to have a very bad labor, has a lot of complications. Firewalker can save her if he uses his magic, and he manages to do so, but he really hurts himself badly doing it. But now that he has his magic again, he says screw it. He sneaks out of the village looking for more evidence and trying to decide what he should do, because he really loves Tahira, but he doesn't trust her. When he returns, he discovers that his old ally, Rootfinder, and his apprentice have tracked him down, and that they've aged 5 years when he's aged like a month. Things have gone really badly for the Sensates in the meantime, and he is suspected of being a traitor. The elders, basically at this point, they support Rootfinder, hoping that he'll either kill or capture Rootfinder before Firewalker discovers the truth of the village. He and Tahira hide in the forest, where he discovers what's really going on. He figures out the mystery of the village, which is that it's a seal that keeps why they have magic in the setting magical, and her father may be alive in the real world. So Firewalker returns to the village before Rootfinder can screw everything up with the seal. They fight, the seal's damaged, and in order to save him, Tahira fixes it, sending Firewalker and Rootfinder's teenage apprentice back to the real world. So the two lovers are separated, and Firewalker is going to go search for her father so that he can get back into the village. And that's where the book ends.
All right. Well done, sir. Good rap. Good summary. Good pitch. So... We start off with the usual disclaimer. Hugh, anything said by myself, by Brian, and most especially by T, could be complete bullshit from this That's point right. forward.
Every total writer, bullshit, yeah.
Every writer has their own style and their own way. You're going to be getting three different views. None of them may be your views, but take what we throw at you as... possibilities. Maybe they'll knock something loose for your own sensibilities, your own sense of the story you want to tell, and definitely don't take any of it seriously. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We defer always to our guest host for opening questions, for observations, and reactions to the story. So, T, what do you got for Hugh about his story so far?
Okay. First off, Hugh. Actually, this is more about more for Brian and Dave. When authors bring their stuff onto the when they bring their stuff onto the
podcast
on the podcast. Thank you. a long day. Am I listening for an entire summary of the book from beginning to end, or am I pretending that I'm the agent and I'm hearing a pitch?
That's actually a good question. Probably a little bit of both.
Okay. Now that I got that, Hugh, first thing I would work on is the pitch itself. because you get a lot of detail. And this is something I see from a lot of first-time authors when they want to pitch something. They start telling me about a story, and I go, okay, stop. Give me an elevator pitch. Now, have you ever heard that term, Hugh, or do you know what that is, an elevator pitch? Okay. You need to develop the elevator pitch. You need to be able to come in and just say it and in and out, bing, boom, because that's what's going to grab their attention first. Because I was trying to come up with a good elevator pitch for you, and I was like lost. I got lost in some of the details, but that is not a criticism of the actual idea. It's a criticism of the pitch. So, and there are three types of pitches you should have. You should have the small, medium, and extra large. Small is a quick summary. Medium is the small is the elevator pitch. Medium is a quick summary, but you don't give them the entire thing. And then the extra large is what you gave us. If you're giving a pitch to somebody and you come out swinging with something that detailed, that might overwhelm somebody. Now, so what I mean by the elevator pitch, I mean you don't sum up the entire story. If you can, great. But if you can just capture the feel of it, like for example, when people ask me, so what's the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences? I basically tell them it's the X-Files steampunk style. Done. And most of the time people go, ooh, tell me more. That's what you want. It's like, you know, with Moravi, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon meets Pirates of the Caribbean. And so develop that pitch first. Now the actual idea itself.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and the stuff that I was hearing, what it sounded like to me, after you reach the end, it sounds a bit like The Bourne Identity meets, for the lack of a better word, The Bourne Identity meets Thor. And you might need to work with the Thor analogy, because what I was thinking about when you were telling me the story that you got here, it reminded me of Thor, the film that Branagh directed, but the story was also in part brought together by J. Michael Straczynski. So you got that going for you, which is nice. Because to get the other guys up to speed with where I was coming from with this, in Thor, if you remember, if you saw the movie Thor,
basically, of course.
kicked ass, of course.
Yeah.
That movie surprised me because of how deep it was. I've never liked Thor as a superhero, but I loved Thor, the film, because here was a guy who was an arrogant prick, and his dad said, then fine, I take away your power and I'm banishing you. Booyah. And he's got to figure out, wait a minute, I'm the fucking God of Thunder. Oh, but none of my shit works. Oh, man. So now he's cooking breakfast for Natalie Portman. Okay, cool. I mean, but you get the idea. He basically chokes on humble pie, and it makes him a better superhero because of it. And that's what it sounds like is happening here. But then with the Bourne Identity element comes in, is you've got Bourne Identity where suddenly he wakes up and he's like, wait a minute, what world am I in? What am I doing? And I don't know how to make this happen. And then he starts unraveling these secrets all about him that they're not telling him. So I see a lot of potential in the story, but do you have an idea of, well, let me ask you this, Hugh, how many books can you tell this guy's story in?
Because it sounds like this is a setup for another book. This is a book that it kind of can stand all alone, but I'm thinking trilogy, I guess.
So here's my second piece of advice. Leave it open. Leave your try to look at your synopsis. Look at your synopsis as the beginning, the middle, and the end. And because you are an untried author, and what I mean by untried author is that you're not published, or you're not published with one of the big six. I mean, and I say this from personal experience. I had under my belt Podcasting for Dummies, Moravi, Two Billies. I had won awards for independent publishing, and when I started with Phoenix Rising, I was a rookie. nearly 10 mm-hmm. years of riding underneath me, and I was still considered a rookie because now I was with the Big Six. So being an untried author, you got to look at your synopsis as the beginning, middle, and end, and you really want to make that story as concise and as standalone as possible with mm-hmm. maybe a few odds and ends that you can leave hanging. Billy does that. The Case of the Singing Sword does that, but that's a story from beginning, middle to end. And so that's what you got to make sure that when that whatever he's dealing with at the beginning of the book, it is resolved at the end of the book, but you still have a direction to go in for a possible sequel if you sell this idea. Make sense? Okay.
Yeah, so I should focus less on he wants to get back with her and he can't, but more on he was having these doubts at the beginning. He went to this place. He's back in the real world, and those doubts are gone.
Right.
Okay.
And as far as the, you know, if you want to develop the relationship, you know, okay, go for it. Develop the relationship. There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
But don't leave it hanging to where, yeah, don't leave it hanging to where he's, I mean, if they're parting company, it's not so that he can go, you know, you don't want her chasing after her. Good example, spoiler alert coming up here, with Geist. Sorsha watches Raid sail off into the sunset, but she sets him on that journey. It wasn't like, I've got to go after him. She's like, no, you got to get out of here. So she basically smuggles him out of the Empire and gets him out of there for safety. But it's open. It's open in that, okay, he's getting away. She's here. We're good. We got this covered. But there's still that little bit of hope that maybe later on he's going to come back for her or she's going to go after him. But if a second book never happens, it's okay. We still got our bases covered. All right.
Good advice.
You want to make sure that first book is as concise and as tight as possible and tells one story from beginning, middle to end.
Yep.
Okay.
Brian, what do you got, bud?
Okay. So the first thing that stands out to me, and I feel like I'm going to start sounding like a kind of like a broken record, because this is the thing that stands out to me the most. And you know how people say that the things that you notice that bother you the most in other people are the things that you don't like about yourself. And so I'm starting to realize that all of my writing is doing this, but what I'm seeing is a passive protagonist. I don't know what he wants, and a lot of things are happening to him.
Okay.
And putting him in particular situations without him driving himself. I think the one place where that isn't happening is in the investigation in the village. He's thrusting himself into that. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what does he want at the beginning? What is it that's going to put him where you need him to be without it being external forces, with it being something that's driving him? And when we talk to you, the other night, you mentioned that he wants to retire. Did you say that tonight too?
Yeah.
So if he wants to retire in the beginning, maybe there's something, you know, it's one of those, but he has to do one last job or he has to accomplish one final task. And this just happens to be something where, you know, he gets sent on the one that none of the other ones want to do, before he'll be either released or relinquished or allowed to give up, you know, whatever it is.
Can I just interrupt for just a sec, Bri?
Yeah, go ahead.
Uh-huh. Hugh, why did you set up this character so that his primary motivation at the beginning is to go rest, which is going to kind of imply that anything he does to get out of whatever jams he gets into from the end of it is ultimately to go rest? What was the thought process behind that?
Well, basically, I wanted to make him want to go rest because I think that's more interesting when all of these political things happen, when he gets that are sort of the result, is that he can't rest.
Right. Okay.
Which creates conflict.
I can see the polar.
I can see the contrast that you've built there.
And now I'm going to jump in. Here's the problem. Here's the problem, though, that I see, Hugh, mm-hmm. is you want him to rest, but we have to go through quite a bit to get to that point. Because I remember when you were telling us about the story, there was a lot of stuff you were saying at the beginning. There's a lot of stuff, lot of stuff to build up to this point. So what you need to do is you either got to do one of two things. You either got to make him, you got to make the motivation for him not to be to rest, because it does create conflict. But for someone to say, I just want to sleep, I just want to rest, I just want to be, you know, just want to be left alone, that it's not
whiny
dynamic
and
enough.
Angsty.
Well, yeah. Now here's the thing, Hugh. If you open, if you open with him saying, all, you know, I mean, I can see the first line right now, of all the things in the world and all the magic he could perform, the only thing he wanted was the one thing he couldn't have.
Bam. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you don't tell us, I just want to rest. You got to show us, you got to show him, you know, he kept looking at like patches of grass and moss. And he thought about the blanket in his backpack. And he had tried so hard to rest, but what was really throwing him was he didn't understand why he couldn't rest. And this is where, again, here's kind of the thing with the Bourne identity, the Bourne identity analogy. Jason Bourne didn't know who he was. He was able to do all these things, and he couldn't understand how he was doing this, why he was doing this, all this stuff. And that's got to be where your character's coming from. It opens with him wanting to rest, but he can't. And because of what has ever happened to him in this battle, he doesn't know why. And now the book becomes the conflict of him wanting to rest and trying very hard. And there are all these people that know him, and he's got to try to figure out, why do these people know me and why are they afraid of me? And then it starts to unravel. And then all that stuff that you did, the buildup, that can be revealed later on in pieces throughout the book.
And if you go back to your theme, to see through illusions and trust instincts, and the awesome magical power that you gave these guys, the kinesthesia, the sensates, which is tailored and wired beautifully into that theme, then you have the illusion that he has bought into. The illusion, you know, I was going to say, you know, if all he wants to do is rest, that's a goad. That's a wonderful goad. But he must be playing these political games because he has this own illusion of, you know, and again, something, but maybe he sees himself to be, I must be the master of all of the sensates. I have to bring peace to the land before I can rest, which is, oh my God, martyr city. A noble goal, and an unattainable one, which is awesome for a hero. So wiring all that in it and hardwiring that tight into the character so that every act, every word, every deed is about not only seeing through the illusion, but also seeing through your own illusions, seeing through those walls that we build around ourselves that we tell ourselves we do because we need to survive, but ultimately become prisons.
Right.
And the beauty of the structure that you've written here is he gets placed in a prison. And if you work it right through his experiences in that prison, through this very different enemy, you know, you can lead him through that maze of his own illusions and come out with this wonderful catharsis at the end and we'll talk more about that later. You know, when his lady love sacrifices himself. Now I wanted to ask this. What is the magic that pulls him into the realm in the first place? And how does Root Finder make his way into the valley later in the story? Those are two things I gotta know.
Okay, basically, the way I have it in my notes, but it's sort of complicated, is that this little village is like sealed itself off like thousands of years ago when the Sempire was founded, because A, they didn't want to be used by the Emperor to, you know, control magic, because that's their thing.
But they are the heart of magic is what this place is, right? It's the heart of magic.
Yeah, it's kind of a fairy realm sort of thing.
Okay, gotcha.
But it's like, it's not Western so much. It's more of a like Persian or Chinese sort of idea.
Love it.
Or sort of setting. But Okay. When the Empire is falling, which is when this story takes place, her father leaves the village, and he kind of leaves a tear there. So when he gets, so when Firewalker gets attacked, he accidentally stumbles across it.
So when her father left the realm, he damaged the realm, and Firewalker got caught in the backlash.
Yes, kind of. That's part of it.
Okay,
but I don't. The one event didn't coincide the two events with the other
didn't
one.
The one event didn't cause the other, but it let it happen.
So like the magic is cracking.
Yes.
Okay, and this is happening all over the place. These little cracks, these little flares of broken magic.
Yeah, there's something kind of off in the village, and that's what Firewalker is seeing.
Okay,
but he doesn't understand it because he's not from the village.
But the event that pulled Firewalker into the village in the first place is a side effect of this magic that's breaking.
In my original notes, it was he was attacked, like it was a chemical weapon that was developed by one of like the Sensate's enemies.
Okay. And how did he end up in the village?
I'm not quite clear on that then, I guess.
It seemed to me that he kind of just wandered through.
Yeah, like he was blinded and then...
He can't see anything. He can't feel anything. And he just sort of happens to slip through.
Like yeah. If the forest is whatever portal that Tahir's father escaped through.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That door was wedged open a crack.
I can see that. And
is it too coincidental?
I think so. I mean, the fact that this big chemical weapon explodes and that's the last thing he remembers is going to set in the reader's mind a cause and effect between that weapon and his arriving in the village. And since he was insensate during that time, there's not going to be anybody to say otherwise.
Oh.
So does that make sense?
Yeah, that's actually a really good idea. So I just wanted to clear this up for T, because I think I was explaining it when he got cut off, and maybe I didn't explain it well. Like, he has his memory, but he lost his powers, and he was, like, blinded and deafened. And since all his powers are through his senses, he can't really understand where he is right away.
Right.
Okay.
So I would say... that event that brings him into the world. If her father by leaving this isolated, purposely intentionally isolated heart of magic to go out into the real world for whatever his motivations are, that's probably for book two. Although you might want to have a defined reason in book one to help inform and lay the groundwork for that.
Why he left, but not necessarily what he's doing.
Right. Exactly. Then in doing so, if there are sparks and flashes going on all over the place, and, you know, by its very nature, magic is grounding where it will ground. In this case, you know, if you have Firewalker invoking an epic spell to blast the enemies, he becomes a perfect grounding rod for this bizarre magic that suddenly starts coruscating around him. And as that magic starts blasting on friend and foe alike, you lay the groundwork for people thinking that he's a traitor.
Ooh.
Which is one of the things that Rootfinder says when he comes back, right?
Right.
You know, he can try, better. He senses the magic unfolding around him. Oh my God. And my friends are being killed along with my enemies. So I must ground this energy. I must pull this energy into me. I must become the vessel of that energy. And in doing so, is drawn back to the source of the magic and suffer sensory overload, bam, because he's a mad mage and his senses are naturally attuned to this anyway. It's like somebody having headphones on and a loud noise blast. Of course you're deafened. Mm-hmm. So, and because his magic is tied to his senses, every sense is literally blown out.
That would actually work really well, because the thing that he is most attuned to is the ability to feel pain.
Boom. There you go.
Yeah.
Ooh, now, really, pain. Ooh, let's go back to that later. Go ahead, Bri.
Well, a question that I have that would maybe be the next step of this is I need some kind of tightening. I need some, you know, I need a reason for everything. And I'm very annoying in that way. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things
very right in that way.
Well, it depends. So one of the things that kind of, you know, it's not bothering me, but it's nagging at the back of my head, is he gets to this realm. He can't see or hear. You know, his senses are gone, and then they come back before anything really significant takes place. So what was the point of him losing them in the first place?
In my notes, it's just sort of so that it more clearly says that something strange is going on, because he still has his synesthesia.
Okay.
So, like, he's getting all these phantom sensations, but not the real ones.
Okay. Because for the first bit of the book,
that's how he's navigating the world.
Right.
Okay. You can use that. I mean, those are going to be the reader's first impressions of this valley and his. So you can really play up that kinesthesia and establish iconic archetypal forms and shapes. I wouldn't spend a lot of time there because that's kind of boring.
That's why I kind of wanted to montage through the recovery. At least a little bit.
Well, and it's a very humbling experience too for a guy who's dealing with a sense. And if you make it that kind of like T was saying, you know, Thor is cast down without powers, you know, giving it that large dose of humble pie.
Right.
If you make him something of an arrogant bastard to begin with, and not wanting to parallel too much with the Thor motif, but someone who's very confident and maybe even blind to the assets of other people around him because he's so confident in his own abilities, that you can play that now.
But that the whole point of that is that then he receives something from that. He learns something. He becomes something better than what he was before. And I don't see that yet here.
Yeah, that's true.
Before he gets his senses back. You know what I mean? So maybe there's something that, because those senses are missing, suddenly he pays attention to a sense that he's been ignoring.
This is part of the hero's journey. This is part of the hero's journey. He's got to learn something from it. And the hardest part about writing of the hero's journey is you don't want it to sound contrived, because it seems like everybody knows the hero's journey. But the reason why we return to the hero's journey is it's a classic story of redemption, and it depends on what you want to do. Do you want to tell an emotional story of one hero's redemption? Back to what back to what it was that made them powerful to begin with, but now they have an appreciation for that power. Or do you want the hero's journey to be, in a sense, the MacGuffin? Do you want it to be where you know he goes through this journey and he feels like, I understand why I've gone through this journey, and then you find out, because you're making references and talking about how the rest of the Society of Magicians, what were they called again?
They're called Sensates.
The Sensates were keeping secrets from him, and it could have been that they were leading him down this path, and that they were manipulating him, and suddenly you find out that the reason why they were leading him down this path, which he thought was the hero's journey, was actually to take him away from a potential threat. It could have, the reason why they were at that war was probably because he started it. You know, that could be a little twist that you throw in there.
Yeah.
And he suddenly realizes, oh my God, you know, this was the reason why he got so burned out. And the reason why he lost his senses, that was part of their plan. Because they needed to regroup, they needed to do they were afraid to tip their hand in this civil war. So you know, it depends on what kind of, you know, what kind of a story, Hugh, do you want to tell? Do you want to tell a classic hero's journey, or do you want to do you want something darker? Do you want to? I mean, there's a story in that idea of yours. There's a very solid story in there, but the one thing I can't tell from the description is what kind of story it is. Whether it is a classic swashbuckling hero's journey type of story, and that's something I see in a lot of fiction is, people want to go dark, and they think that's a trend, and you know, maybe it is a trend, but if you're going to do that, you got to go all the way. It can't be a halfway thing. And if you go dark in your first book, there's got to be some body count. So you might want to have you considered, I'm putting the writer on the spot, Hugh, have you considered what kind of a story is this? Did you want it? What kind of story do you want to tell? Do you want to tell a story of redemption, a story of a journey to finding self-worth? Or do you want to tell a story that's a little sinister, a little diabolical, and it turns out that this guy who thinks he's on a hero's journey is actually a pawn in a much larger game?
Yeah, well, I think I definitely like the idea of the hero's journey, but I do like the idea of him being very bound by honor. Mm-hmm. And that honor is, he thinks he's doing a bad thing for a good reason. He's doing a bad thing for a bad reason.
Right.
And that's sort of where the rest of the trilogy, if it ends up being a trilogy, would go.
So what you can do to illustrate that is with that opening segment, making sure that you've defined very clearly the political pieces that are in motion that have brought Firewalker to where he is. And then recreate that same scenario in the valley, not overtly one-to-one parallels, but the metaphorical manipulations and political maneuverings. I mean, with the father gone, the daughter is now maybe in place in rule, and not everybody in the village thinks she should. And you can,
that could be a good sort of like, he needs to save her because he was. He had this job to save this warlord whose father died, and he failed.
Right. And then you can have that revelationary moment of, you know, if his counsel leads to war, leads to an escalation in the valley, then he can see, oh my God, it's happening again. And now it's with this woman who I actually care about rather than some lord who I didn't. And it drives the point home. And now there's a turning point for your hero to evolve and move to that next stage of awareness and nobility. And that gives you something to happen in the village. Because right now the village scenario is sounding kind of flat. You've taken us from epic battle and magic and swords into a tranquil Persian village with stuff off in the corner there.
And you know, another thing that you can do with that is if he believes that he was the cause of both, just like Dave was saying, the one character that we still have in common from both places is Root Finder.
Yes.
So there's also the possibility that while he, you know, maybe he was, because this is kind of 180-ing the whole idea that he is, you know, to blame. But, you know, he could have been set up both times because Root Finder is there in both scenarios.
Well, and the cool thing could be, you know, if Root Finder believes he's a traitor and has come to find him because he's a traitor and he wants to join up, and Root Finder's not really all that night. And see, I'm going dark again.
Yeah. Right. Usually that's my job. But
yeah, I know. But we both walk in those waters,
I'm kind of enjoying the, you know, the honor bound and the lighter side of life.
Well, and T raises a good point. It really does come down to the story you want to tell, Hugh. And it sounds like you want to tell a hero's arc.
Right.
So, but see, the thing is with Root Finder coming back, let me just walk down this potentially dark path for a second. You guys pull my ass back if I go crazy. But if Root Finder comes back and is all for Firewalker because he's a badass, because he believes he's a traitor, because he thinks that it's time for a change and Firewalker's the one to do it, then that holds a dark mirror up to who Firewalker was. That he was living a life that invoked this kind of reaction. And it's the final choice. It's the temptation. Here it is. You know, Rootwalker has 550 wizards and 100 mercenaries on the other side of this path, ready to follow your every word, my lord. You know, we can come in here and take over this valley. We can go out there and lay waste to your enemies. What do you do?
Well, he's at the source of magic, isn't he?
Well, yeah, but there's something wrong with the source of magic.
Right. So maybe he's the one that can tap into it and.
Well, he can either fix it or he can enslave it.
Well, there you go.
T, what are you? I'm sorry, man. We're just freaking rambling here.
No. I'm just, hey, I'm just sitting back enjoying the ride.
There's a lot of world building stuff in here.
Yeah, and
we're focusing really on the story at this point. The world building is strong. There's stuff to be done with it. We can work with it.
Remember the thing about world building. You know, the world building, you can always fill the blanks in. You can fill the blanks in later.
Exactly.
I mean, I see people just obsess over world building, and I'm like, that's great. When are you going to, I remember hearing a story, and this was like 5 years ago, that it was a discussion on one of the writing groups that I was involved with. Someone had spent literally 5 years building the world. And I said to him, I said, so when are you going to get to writing the story? And he goes, well, I got to finish the world first. I'm like, why? And the world building is, it's a beautiful thing when it's done well, but at the same time, if that's all you do, you're never going to get to the story.
Right.
The world serves the story, not the other way around.
Right. Right.
But this does have a cool thing, because the source of magic, mm-hmm. like, he could tap into it, and that'd make him more powerful in his lifetime. But like, however many hundred years down the road, it would create a huge monster. Part of the way this
so the choice
magical
is,
ecosystem works.
Do I heal the source of magic so that the magic can sustain in the world, or do I use the last of the magic to make things quote-unquote right in the world right now?
Mm. Yeah, that's one hell of a choice right there.
I like that. That's the horns of a dilemma, baby.
Right. Because it's a either way, there's a good outcome and a horrible outcome.
Right.
Are you God, or are you just going to let the world, are you going to maintain the potential for magic to exist forever? You know, and that might be one of the issues. I mean, is magic an illusion? Is magic, again, going back to your theme, which I really, really like, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, how does that tie into that final choice? Because that really is, I mean, that's the climax. At the end, when Tahira is, mm-hmm. is, you know, fixing the seals, the seal of magic for him or pushing him through at the very end, that moment, that's the climax, baby. That's where whatever issues and themes and arc you've been building for your characters, that's the payoff. That's where the answer of is your hero a hero or not answered. And you as the writer get the choice to frame that question any way you want with every action and every choice of every character throughout the story. So a lot of what we're talking about here, I think, Hugh, is finding that path to that final moment. And what that choice is and what type of person is going to stand there making that choice when we get there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's okay for him to make terrible choices along the way.
Good Lord. Yeah. Yeah. When characters make bad choices, that's always a beautiful thing.
Right.
And the thing about making bad choices is it actually makes your characters human. And right. I really believe that's what you want. You really want that in your characters, even in fantasy, because if you have nothing but perfect characters, you have Twilight. Mm-hmm. and
look, how nobody wants that.
And you know, and so it's just something to consider. It's just something to consider.
Yep.
If they make a poor choice, what's the fallout? We obviously don't want our characters to make poor choices, but sometimes they have to.
Yeah.
Sometimes they have to, and it's part of what. In fact, in the Janus affair, I remember Pip and I had this huge debate over that. There's a rugby game. There's a rugby game that we put into the book, and it was to show how Wellington was a little vulnerable. And I had him break the rules. And Pip was like, he can't do that. And I said, what do you mean you can't do that? He's breaking the rules of the game. I was like, yeah. And she went, but T, he's breaking the rules. He'd be thrown out of the game. I'm like, that's right. But T, he's breaking the, he looks like a dick. I'm like, yes, he does. And it was
which
one
makes
of those
him more endearing, more authentic, and more,
yeah,
more worthy of the hero's cycle than a perfect character who has nowhere to go.
Right, right.
And that's, even, and that really is the, I mean, that's the hero's arc right there.
And the best part of it was a choice he makes. It wasn't thrust upon him. It wasn't happenstance. Right. And it does, it actually does move forward. It moves the plot forward. In a different angle.
Absolutely.
And it's making poor choices. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with the character making a poor choice.
And to tie it back to your story, Hugh, I'm sorry, I'm going to stay out and talk about every story. Perfect people don't go on heroes quests. Broken people go on heroes quests.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the whole purpose of the hero's quest is to reintegrate both with your personal inner self and the higher self, the potential that you can be, to find that sword in the stone, to find, bring back your wife from the land of the dead, whatever. So Firewalker needs to be broken in some way. And I take that back. If you choose to make Firewalker broken at the beginning, you have a clearer path to bring him to that apotheosis at the end when he becomes the hero that he can be. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, and I can totally see how I can make that work better.
Excellent.
And the roots of that are already here.
Yes,
like
absolutely.
You know, you have the instinct by saying that he wants to retire. You know, I don't know that you've closed on exactly what he wants.
He's seen a lot of bad things.
Right. And so that's it, right? You know, I mean, that's part of his broken spirit. And you already have that there. It's just a matter of really getting to the core of it.
Well, yeah, and that's it. That's it. Oh, my God, that's it. Exactly. He's seen so many horrible things. He's broken in spirit. He believes he has nothing else to give. Which is an illusion. And somehow through the telling of this story, he discovers that whatever wounds to his soul or to his body or whatever that he has taken, that they mean nothing, because whatever it is that he truly believes in, not that he needs rest, it needs to be something else. But whatever he truly believes in is an infinite source of life energy, of power, personal power, and the ability to hold your head high no matter what darkness is showered upon you, no matter what horrors you witness. Something will sustain you through that, whether it's a faith, whether it's a belief in magic or a belief in the ultimate goodness of people or whatever. And you need to decide that for Firewalker. You know him better than we do.
And maybe that's why he loses his senses in the first place. It's, you know, it may be sort of a side effect of whatever that blast is, but maybe there's something that he witnesses in that blast that is the last thing that breaks him.
Yes.
So that he loses it. And the whole time he's thinking, oh, it's the blast. It was something in the blast, but it's not. It's in him. And it's something that he has to discover to find a way to get that back, which then gives you a reason to bring it back to him instead of just, well, he finally does sort of rest a little bit in the village and his powers come back. You know, through the helping a woman give birth and through using it for positive things, he gets a little tiny bit back at a time.
Right, right.
You know? Because that was my other question is, you know, you've sort of pinpointed and emphasized that he's forbidden to use magic, but he does use a little bit, or he uses enough to you know, it takes a lot out of him to help a woman give birth. And I didn't quite understand what the point of that piece was. Because if you take it out, for me, it doesn't change the story at all. So maybe work that in. That's part of, you know, now he's using magic for something completely different than what he used it for in the real world. And it's more, it's the good part of it instead of we have to have magic to defend ourselves or to fight or to, you know, influence or whatever. Now it's use magic to give and help with life.
Yeah.
You know?
And don't give him back his magic. Don't give him back his magic until Talia or Tahira starts walking him around to these shrines, which are the actual seals and essences of magic.
Yes.
That are leaking. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So only when he comes into contact with that does he have any magic. When he leaves that proximity, he loses his magic again. Until he starts healing that wound in his soul that has caused him. I love that, Brian. The you know, it's almost like hysterical blindness. It's mm-hmm. one last right. thing that has broken my heart, and I've lost my power. And only through the love of Tahira and the belief in I don't know, the goodness of the village, whatever.
Right. It's kind of a rebirth.
Yeah. T, are we waxing weird, or are you tracking with this?
I'm tracking with it, and that is why I'm quiet. I'm quiet because it's, there are no wrong answers here. There really are no wrong answers here. I mean, in fact, I'm actually surprised Hugh's head hasn't imploded right now.
we need to start wrapping this up because
he's either ferociously taking notes or he's just like Mongol like candy. You know what I mean?
It's tree pity, it's pretty Udo. Fire bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, and so, but really, wow. Wow. Whenever you get into like heavy duty brainstorming like this, it can be a little overwhelming, but it comes back. The thing is, we're not the ones writing the story. You're the ones writing the story. You Absolutely. Have to tell, and you have to make the choice of all the stuff that's being thrown here by Dave, by Brian, and myself. You got to figure out what part of this can I use, and what part of this is just these guys, you know, wanking off, touching themselves. but enough about me. It really comes back to okay. What Dave is saying here makes perfect sense. That can work. What T's saying here, elements of it work, but I don't think that works at all. And Brian, yeah, Brian's also hitting some points, you know, somewhere in between. So what you have to do is take the massive truckload of the metric fuck ton of
awesomeness. Advice.
Of awesomeness and love and joy that we're wrapping up for you and then you basically have to sort it out. You've got to say, all right, where do I apply this to my story? And the one last parting nugget of advice I'm going to give you is don't second guess yourself. If your instinct, if your writer's instinct is telling you, this is the direction I need to go in. Follow that direction. And don't stop and go, but T said, or but Brian said, or but Dave said.
Yep.
If your instinct tells you these guys are right up to this point and then the rest of it is shit, then you know what? Trust that instinct.
Absolutely. Trust it.
Right.
I couldn't wrap it up better myself, T. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Brian, any last words for Master Hugh?
No, I think take that to heart because that honestly, you know, when I used to direct plays, that was one of the things that as a director you have to do with actors is if I told an actor how to say a line, it would never come out naturally. The actor has to figure it out. They have to find it on their own so that it's natural for them. And so, you know, that's a really rough way of kind of reiterating what T just said. So take what T said and forget what I just said and apply it 100%, you know, because if you like an idea that one of us threw out, but you only like it because you know, but if it's not something that you glom onto 100%, then don't even bother with it, you know, but it's a really, really good, rich amount of stuff here.
Yeah.
And so
yeah, we don't riff like this if there's not something to riff on, bud.
Exactly.
So
yeah, there's a lot of really interesting choices that I can make that I really have to sit down and say, okay, what's most natural?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. If you haven't figured it out yet, this part of this podcast is partly self-serving because everybody that comes on this podcast loves this stuff and loves to talk about, ooh, it could be this, it could be that, it could be whatever. And that's the thing. It could be. You're the one who decides what will be.
Right.
So,
bam.
And then when you make $1 million, you can
come back
and let us know.
Yes, please. Mm-hmm. So we can plaster your name all over the website under our success stories link that someday will actually exist. Right. So please, absolutely. Do you swear this, Master Hugh?
I solemnly swear.
Oh, awesome. And we got him on tape. Yes.
Absolutely.
So we can play this at the Hugos. We can play this. Like, Hugh, you said, dude. While you're taking
And Hugh's going to look at us and go, I'm sorry, you're who again?
Yeah. So
I'll be looking at all you guys going, yeah, back in my day.
I remember when
two tin cans and some fishing wire. Fuck you all.
That's right, damn it. Get off my lawn, you damn kid.
When did Team Morris become Harlan Ellison? Holy shit.
Oh, you must spit much more vitriol in order to be Harlan Ellison, dude.
Right.
All right. Hugh, was there anything that you specifically were hoping that T would touch on, or a question that you wanted to ask T in relation to this story that we didn't get around to?
Does the romance work? As a
romance, romance. You know, the thing about romance that you want to be careful about, again, it's like anything. You want the romance to be genuine, and you don't want to throw it in there just for the sake of throwing in romance. If the romance feels forced, they'll see right through it. They will see right through your readers will see right through it. So, I mean,
why did you have it in there, Hugh?
Yeah, I mean, if the romance is there as a ways and means of moving the story, and more importantly, moving the characters forward, then it works. If it's there because, well, she's a hottie, he needs a hottie, I'm going to give him a hottie. So you have to decide. You have to decide. Okay, what kind of, you know, what does the romance bring for you, Hugh? What do you feel the romance brings to it?
Well, I think it not only gives him a reason to do a lot of the stuff he does in the village, it also creates sort of the tension of, I want to stay here, I want to leave, I want to keep everything I'm doing secret, I want to tell her what I'm doing.
So do you feel that the romance does it move your character forward? No.
See, I was going to say, Hugh, the fact that you even asked that question calls into question whether you need that romance or not.
And
because you're not feeling it.
That's the other thing too. You said, I think it does. No. It either does or it doesn't.
You know, try the story without it. Try the story with him respecting her, with him admiring her for her leadership and her willingness to bear the burden of her father disappearing and still leading her people effectively.
Part of the charm and part of what made the X-Files so good in its first season.
Yeah.
Was that Mulder respected Scully.
Yeah.
And Scully eventually grew to respect Mulder. And then the fans were like, we want to see them together. And then when they got together, it was part of the disaster that was the final few seasons.
It was now, the tease that made it interesting.
Yeah. Then you've got, since we talked about the almighty Joss, then you got Firefly. You've got this tension between Inara and Mal. And they don't respect each other. They act like a bickering old couple. And yet you can tell you want them desperately to be together. And then in the series, when Mal does sleep with somebody and you see Inara fall apart, you just feel like shit because you're like, no, it's not supposed to be like this. It's not supposed to be like this. And that, you know, that moves, that's the kind of romance, that's the kind of tension that moves both characters forward.
So to expand on T's admonition to follow your instincts, Hugh, mm-hmm. I'm so totally behind that, and I agree with it 100%. The corollary to that is don't rely on your instincts. Trust them by all means. Follow them where they go, but understand the fact that not everything that you glom onto as a writer is necessarily the first choice, is not always the best choice. And if right. you start having questions like that, if you start raising questions like that, then play the game of 180 and go the exact opposite direction. What if she hates him? What if he respects her and wants to love her, and she despises him for being what he is, a vile user of magic, the depleter of the essence, the squanderer of magic? What does that do to the story? Play the what if game and see if that gives more tension and more mojo to the story to make you keep writing that next page. Ooh, what is she going to insult him with next or whatever? So, I mean, romance is good, but like T says, man, if it doesn't serve the story and doesn't amplify, not just move forward, but put it into fifth gear, then maybe a different choice will give you that.
Right.
Gentlemen?
Yes.
I really
stick a fork in it. I think we're done.
I think so. I think we have mined this bad boy for some awesome, awesome gold.
Absolutely.
T, dude, thank you so much. This has been not only a hugely awesomely good time, but very enlightening. And we really appreciate you coming on and sharing so generously of your many roads traveled for the benefit of not only Hugh, but Brian, me, and our listeners. We're very grateful.
I appreciate that. Thanks, yes. guys.
Yep. Awesome.
Definitely. Yep.
All right, my friends. I don't know about you, but I need a cigarette and a scotch, man.
It's been cold and rainy here in the Washington D.C. area, so I'm heading straight for blankets and bed.
Awesome.
I'm done.
We're all done.
Tapping out.
So, friends, thank you so much for hanging out with us as we all spent ourselves in this episode. There's an image for you, huh? And if you enjoyed this, if you've been enjoying the podcast, please consider making your way out to iTunes and dropping a review on us. That helps us in so many ways. If you've got ideas for Hugh's story that we didn't cover, and heaven knows there's a lot of ground yet to travel yet, put a comment on the post at roundtablepodcast.com.
There it is.
And continue the conversation there. Drop us a line at the table at roundtablepodcast.com. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And
got your back.
You totally do. You totally do. And it scares me in ways I can't describe. and in general, that's it. Brian, what do we say?
Go right.
That's it. I'm sure there's something else to be said, but dudes, that's all there is.
All been said.
We'll see you in a few days with yet another awesome 20 minutes with and another writing session. Until then, be good, go right, and we will definitely catch you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBroyer, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.